in Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History, people often think of that as a kind of incorrect book that he kind of said that everything was over and people wouldn't argue. He doesn't say that really. He says that
it's the most misinterpreted book in recent history. I'll just go there.
It is.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join me today. Before we jump into our topic and I introduce our guest, I just wanted to say a word about the next Bulwark Book Club that I'm so looking forward to. My colleague Bill Kristol and I are going to be discussing Mark Twain's wonderful book, Pudd'nhead Wilson, which I have read and which I have to tell you is great. I mean, it's a fun read. It's a quick read. And it's full of really interesting both storytelling techniques and historical interest. So we would love to get feedback from the audience. And this one is going to be a live taping. And so we would love to hear from you, get your questions, comments. Please feel free to send some in ahead of time. There's a link in the show notes. And there will be more online. So that will be coming up on August 12th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. So that's August 12th, 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Join us for Mark Twain, Pudd'nhead Wilson. And now I would like to introduce my guest. He is staff writer at The Atlantic, Idris Kaloun. And Idris is one of the most interesting and stimulating writers over at The Atlantic, which is saying something because they have quite the crew. And so he has two pieces that I want to dig into today. So Idris, first of all, thanks again for returning to the Mona Charon Show.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And so I want to start with your piece about Donald Trump's policies and whether they are actually undermining American greatness. If you don't mind my paraphrasing your thesis. So you start with a quotation from him from July 4th saying, "We will always be on top. We will never let our country fall." And I think it's fair to say that his followers believe him to be enhancing American stature, wealth, power, and so forth. And so tell me your thesis of what you think is going on instead.
Well, I think that there is a difference between short-term and long-term. And I think that what, you know, Trump has always argued and his supporters have always said is, you know, if he's so bad, why is the economy doing as well as it has? Why did the economy do as well as it did in his first term? And why is it not really suffering anything in this term now? And the point that I make in the piece is that a lot of the actions that he is taking aren't manifesting in kind of short-term decline, both because they've coincided with an AI boom that has been very helpful to him. But what they are doing is undermining the determinants of long run growth. So the way that we are going to reduce immigration, even for high skilled migrants, that affects the pace at which you can generate ideas, the attacks on universities. They won't immediately register in terms of, you know, American GDP, but in terms of who produces breakthroughs in 20 or 25 years from now, that will show up. And I think that if you see this framework...
Could I just underline that? Let's pause on that for a second, because you make the argument, and I'd like to hear more about it, that ideas are what propel growth in our time. It isn't, you know, having a lot of oil and gas under your real estate. It's not things like that. It's really all about ideas. And what he is doing is inhibiting our capacity to bring in the best minds, right?
Yeah, I think increasingly, you know, materials matter. It's good that America sits on fossil fuels like it does, and that's helpful. But, you know, the pace at which you generate ideas is what determines growth. You know, productivity is only boosted by having more ideas. And the institutions that you have that allow people to profit, to have, stable expectations that if they do innovate, they will keep the returns, that the marketplace is fair, that, you know, if they win fairly, that, you know, the state won't interfere either because they have a kind of regulatory agenda or because, you know, they are out of political favoritism. This is one problem with, you know, lots of countries that have gone down the route of corruption. You know, they see very anemic growth because it the marketplace becomes unfair, right? It is a very unhelpful kind of development. And what we see, you know, again, with Trump's actions and the kind of open profiting off of cryptocurrency, the way that, you know, it seems like you can, you know, commit financial crimes and donate the right amount and therefore get a pardon. All of that undermines people's perceptions of the fairness of the market. And that's why you see kind of business leaders in the way that they talk about Trump with this kind of timidity that is a bit unusual. And, you know, again, this doesn't mean that in the short term, everything falls apart. But what it does mean is that, you know, little by little, the American kind of marketplace that is the ultimate generating force for prosperity, and we have a lot of it, you know, that starts to be diminished. And I think a lot of his actions, if you look at them on this dimension, are kind of borrowing from America's future greatness.
So the sources of American greatness are the stability of our society, the fact that people can trust in our institutions, that we won't, for example, confiscate any investment that foreigners choose to make or anybody chooses to make. The government won't confiscate your wealth. That happens in other countries. That's a problem. We don't have that. We have very reliable rule of law, or we did. We had a very open immigration policy, and we had a great research and development infrastructure, and also that was linked to our openness to immigration by, now, I, as viewers of this program know, I'm sort of a cross-the-board pro-immigrant person, but it's particularly important, and you made this point in the piece, which I also have written about, which is that if you look at the American dominance in Nobel Prizes over the last 50 years, 35% of the American winners of the Nobel Prize in chemistry, medicine, economics, and physics, 35% were immigrants. I was just listening to the radio this morning, and they were talking about applications to PhD programs in this country are way down. And part of that is because really smart students from other places are not applying here. I mean, they're getting the message loud and clear. And one of the things you say is that the administration has talked about putting a 4-year cap on student visas. Talk about that, if you would, and the link to economic growth.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, most PhDs take longer than 4 years. So if you're a prospective PhD student and you see that there's this regulatory change that you know, the administration is talking about, that means that you might get kicked out or have to leave the country before your PhD is finished. Why would you come? And you know, it is quite the benefit to America that we have, one person, it was actually Nicholas Christakis at Yale, told me this, and it's always stuck in my head. But he said that America's superpower is that we brain drain the rest of the world. And that's very, very true. You know, a lot of our kind of cutting edge professors, a lot of our AI prominence and preeminence is due to imported talent, in the sense that, you know, people come here, they want to live here. It's a great place to live, to raise kids, and they stay. You know, I'm perfectly willing to understand the argument that America could be more selective about the kinds of migrants that it takes in. But what this administration is doing is it's saying all migrants, no matter what, are not, you know, we don't want any of them. And that includes high skilled, low skilled, you know, and the effect of that will again be manifest in kind of 20, 25 years. It'll manifest in fewer breakthroughs. It'll manifest in fewer ideas, fewer successful companies, of which immigrants of this caliber tend to produce a lot of as well. So, you know, that is one thing where, again, you're not going to see in the immediate future any change, right? Because we already have a lot of people who are here, who are producing ideas and innovations and patents and companies and all sorts of other things. So you won't see an immediate decline. But, you know, if these policies continue, you will see a difference. And I guess I would add, just while we're talking about it, you know, some, you know, other stability that people, the other kinds of stability that people take into account are, you know, the monetary stability and independence of the Federal Reserve, which is also something that the president is very eager to undermine, and also the stability of the dollar and, you know, the American debt, and the fact that, you know, this isn't a unique Trump phenomenon, but the fact that debt is exploding over his period means that at some point, there will have to be some kind of fiscal reckoning that America has to deal with. And all of that, again, you know, Donald Trump will be long gone by the time that arrives. But when it does arrive, you know, it will be hard for America to go through.
Let's take a minute and talk about OneSkin. I actually want to talk about two products here today. The topical supplement, which is the moisturizer that I use in the morning underneath makeup. And this is the eye cream. And I have to say, look at this. I mean, they give you a good amount in this product. Some of the things you get are like this. They sell you, you look online, it looks like it's a big bottle and it's this tiny little thing. But this is a really generous amount of eye cream. It does not irritate your eyes, which is a big issue for me. This is completely non-toxic, non-irritating, and it smooths out the very delicate skin around your eyes. And I like it as much as the moisturizer. So you've heard about OneSkin, and whether you're someone who tries every new skincare product that hits the market, or you've been using the same one or two things for years, at some point, most of us realize our skin isn't keeping up the way it used to. Born from over a decade of longevity research, OneSkin is helping to unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. As we age, some skin cells stop functioning the way they should. Longevity scientists call them zombie cells, and that's what's actually driving those visible signs of aging, the fine lines and dullness that creeps in over time. And OneSkin's OS1 peptide was specifically engineered to address those. So you're getting everything you expect from great skincare with OS1 doing something that most skincare was never built to do. Further, it goes on very smooth. I like the fact that it keeps your skin soft and supple without being greasy. I don't like products that are greasy, and this one is not. It just absorbs very quickly into your skin, makes it very smooth. Born from over a decade of longevity research, OneSkin is helping you unlock your healthiest skin now and as you age. For a limited time, try OneSkin with 15% off using code MonaCharon at oneskin.co/MonaCharon. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code MonaCharon. After you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them, so please support our show and tell them we sent you. Imagine that you're speaking to a Doge-loving MAGA supporter who says, what do you mean Trump is responsible for an explosion of the debt? That's not true. They went in there, Elon Musk with their, you know, with their chainsaw, and they cut government spending. So we're taking care of that problem.
I would just say, like, look at the statistics. You know, the debt, you can look at the debt clock, you know, that everyone kind of believes that is true. And I mean, I don't have the numbers to hand, but I think it's gone up.
So what happened in the Big Beautiful Bill?
The Big Beautiful Bill extended the tax cuts from 2017, which are unfunded, right? There isn't a mechanism to make up for them. There is an attempt to make up for the cuts by imposing Medicaid work requirements and cuts on food stamps and other things. And that does reduce the overall cost, but not by enough to compensate for it. So that will add trillions to the deficit or deficits over time. And what we know about the effect of tax cuts on growth is that they're not compensated, right? So they're not made up. That was true of the 2017 tax cut, which saw deficits increase dramatically. You know, no one can say that Democrats have done much better. I mean, Biden exploded the deficit in his own way. Yeah. But what we see is this trajectory of increased spending and no real attempt at reducing that. You know, America's above 100% of GDP in debt, and there's no sign that it's gonna decline anytime soon.
How does this compare with Great Britain? You made this comparison in your piece.
Well, one thing that was interesting to me, I wrote a long piece about what went wrong with Britain a few weeks ago, and there it's interesting. They've been stuck in the kind of economy that Americans sometimes imagine they're in. You know, there has been no wage increase over 18 years. very, very little productivity growth. Energy is extremely expensive. And that has really sapped the country of a lot of vitality, of a lot of kind of trust in the political system. And I think it's accelerated their political dysfunction, which we see now that they're on their seventh prime minister. But in this piece, I guess Britain was on my mind. But one thing I point out is that Rudyard Kipling was asked to write a poem about, you know, to dedicate it to the country at the time of Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. And that was kind of 1890s. Britain was at the height of its empire. And he turned in this kind of somber meditation on what might happen if Britain were to decline, this kind of memory of you know, Britain's navies being useless and cast aside. And it's quite humble at a time of kind of
maybe not what they were expecting from Rudyard Kipling, huh?
No. He had actually started working on White Man's Burden around the same time, which is this kind of infamous poem. And he could have turned that in, but something caused him to try to write in a different register. And it was quite effective. And the contrast for me between Trump's kind of, you know, chest thumping speech on July 4th and the tenor of that poem, I thought was quite interesting.
Another source of American strength that we should talk about, though, I think I don't remember whether you touched on this, because honestly, you could make an argument that Trump is doing everything possible to make the United States a weaker country, not a stronger country. And I would cite also the fact that he is destroying our alliances. You know, he has a picture of the United States that is frozen in amber from, you know, about 1967, when, you know, we were a colossus on the world stage in terms of our economy and all the rest of it. But we are no longer that. I mean, China's huge. There are a lot of countries that have grown, which is great. I mean, everybody, the whole world is richer. But the notion that we on our own can dictate terms to the rest of the world is not true. And before Trump came into power, we had created alliances with wealthiest and the most productive nations on earth, the freest and most productive nations on earth. And that was a source of strength for us. And he's dismantling it.
I mean, after the Second World War, right, we designed a international economic system in which America was the keystone of that. And similarly for military alliances, you know, America designed NATO, and we have, you know, various other alliances in Asia and elsewhere, which America again is the keystone. And what Trump sees when he looks at that is weakness. He sees that these alliances as sources of leverage that can be milked, right? So whether through tariffs, which countries don't like paying, but a country like Japan, which is so militarily reliant on America, simply has to, right? The Europeans don't like paying it, but they feel that they're, again, that their military reliance on America is such that they have to. What does this do? In the short term, again, the countries pay up. Mm-hmm. In the medium to long term, they think, okay, America's no longer reliable. We have to figure out, Mark Carney has elucidated this very well, the middle power.
Prime Minister of Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, who you know, says, you know, America is no longer reliable ally. We have to think about how we position ourselves between China, Russia, et cetera. It's voluntarily giving up the kind of preeminence that America had in these systems. And it's very interesting, you know, in Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History, people often think of that as a kind of incorrect book that he kind of said that everything was over and people wouldn't argue. He doesn't say that, really. He says that
it's the most misinterpreted book in recent history. I'll just go there.
It is. But, you know, one thing that he says, and you know, as well, is that even when we attain kind of liberal democracy, people will strive against it for the sake of having something to strive against. Yes. And that has been the most, you know, prescient prediction that he's made. You know, America is kind of at the height of of its power militarily and economically, and we're giving it up. And why I still fully don't grasp, even after all these years. But it's a very kind of interesting place that we find ourselves in.
I know. On that point, I have struggled with the same question. It is mysterious to me that people in this country, so many and spanning the political spectrum, if that even means anything anymore. But this pervasive sense that that things are terrible, that the country has failed them, that there's nothing to be faithful to or to be appreciative of. I find that remarkable, and the fact is, we've never been more fortunate than we are now, and we stand every chance of killing the goose that laid the golden egg, just out of what I don't know, ingratitude, restlessness, longing for struggle. I don't know, but it is very, very disturbing. And let's say a word about the alliance structure also, because one thing, so you point out, and it's very true, that many of the consequences of what Trump and MAGA are doing are not going to be felt instantly. They take time, but that it's like termites, you know, eating away at the foundations, and it will weaken us. But some things are already evident, like people reconsidering buying weapon systems from us. So some of our allies are shopping around because they just don't know if they want to be that linked with America, because we're not necessarily a reliable ally. And, you know, it would have been one thing if Trump had only been elected once, but he was elected twice. And now people have to, you know, as one European diplomat famously said, you know, we can't let our national security be dependent on the whims of swing state voters every 4 years. And so that is already happening. But let's talk also for a minute about China, because a couple things are worth dwelling on, I think, for a sec. One is that Trump devoted maybe more before his first term than the second term, but also, you know, previous to the second, a big theme, big MAGA theme was, we need to do all these things because we have to beat China. And China's the big threat, and we have to diminish them through sanctions through trade sanctions, through tariffs, and through other means, because they are the big threat. So the first part I want to talk about is Trump threatened China. I mean, he really let things, like the first term, perhaps he was more inhibited because of his advisors. This term, he just let it fly. And let's, you know, tariff, he kept changing the tariffs every week, the percentages. I mean, it was just an insane way to make public policy. But anyway, the fact is, if you look at the famed trade deficit, which Trump thinks is a measure of that's important, which it isn't. But even if you look at the trade deficit, it's utterly unchanged between the Biden administration and the Trump administration.
Right.
So, and then China is doing great at the moment in terms of its world trade, right? It's trading less with us, but it's trading more with everybody else. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, there are intermediaries like Vietnam that you know, Chinese goods can go through. And I think that there's a lot there, but, you know, just a few.
Well, tell me if I'm wrong about anything I just said, and or elaborate if you wish.
A few things. One is your point about how a lot of MAGA's arguments have been predicated on, well, we're in a great power competition with China and we need to win. Therefore, we shouldn't do stupid stuff in the Middle East. I mean, Elbridge Colby, I feel bad for him, right? The Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, right? So before Trump comes into office, he says, look, we need to stop sending arms to Ukraine. We need to really cut off the rest of the world because of China. China is such a threat that we need to focus all of our energy onto that. And he's kind of, you know, now been put in a position where, like, he has to defend the United States militarily intervening in Iran and depleting a lot of its munitions, as he warned we should not do before the election.
I'm much less inclined than you to feel sorry for him, actually, because I think his position was wrong ab initio. I mean, the idea that you show how strong you are to China by abandoning your ally in Ukraine always struck me as a bit wrongheaded, but
No, fair enough. But even if you credit it, he's had to implement the exact opposite of, of what he's intended. And I think also, you know, China's arguments about the way that the world works, the way that power works, have been vindicated by this administration. So what they have said to other countries is, look, the West lies to you. They say that they care about human rights. They say they care about international law, but really they just do whatever they want. And yeah, people can criticize us, but really our principle is that you should just be able to do whatever you want internally to your country. No one should tell you otherwise. And everyone's a hypocrite. And what they've seen now is, you know, the United States intervening militarily in Venezuela, in Iran, really without really any attempt of making, you know, an argument for why this is justified under international law.
Or under domestic law.
You know, Congress is, you know, just AWOL on this. You know, Stephen Miller gives an interview to CNN where he says, well, it's, you know, the law of the jungle that might do what they want and everything. And, you know, this vindicates China's position. So to other countries, I don't think people really inherently want to have a Chinese-led world order. I don't think that that's particularly attractive to people. But, you know, the arguments that they make that now just so oddly resemble you know, their fears that they think, okay, well, maybe we just have to hedge our bets. And I think that is what is going on. For a lot of countries, yep. They're having to decide between, okay, well, America's not reliable. China's there. China's an option. You know, that again is a lot, because I don't think people want a kind of autocratic government, in charge of world policy. And they don't want a country that's, you know, that doesn't breach democracy and human rights, however hypocritical America might have been in that approach. So I think, you know, a lot of this has been to China's benefit.
One more note I just want to add about the China thing. You know, Trump is famous for, you know, throwing rhetorical elbows and being very belligerent in his speech. And he did that again. He's done it in spades in the second term. And he went after China and claimed that, you know, he was going to bring them to heel with the threat of these tariffs and that they would have no choice but to capitulate. And instead, Xi Jinping said, you've got tariffs and that's your weapon. We've got rare earths. And why don't you pick up the story from there? What did the Trump administration do in response?
Yeah, no, they've had to back down from the extremely high heights that they set the tariffs at, right? I think they're now maybe 20-30%, but they were initially, I think, 150, 160. Silly territory. But China was the only country that really had the strength to push back. You know, even India didn't like being pushed around, but had to accept that. That has led to relations souring between America and India. The European Union didn't like being pushed around, but they kind of had to accept it as well. China knows that it has these dependencies that America relies on. Rare earths are one of them, but, you know, they've also stopped buying soybeans in big amounts, which has hurt farmers who support Trump as well. So, you know, but this is not really, I don't know what we are getting from this kind of tariff policy. We have a demonstration of strength, which I guess is very attractive to Trump. Let's just back away from this for a moment, but the idea that a president could unilaterally set tariff rates without Congress is a completely new innovation, right? That Supreme Court eventually said the way that he was using emergency powers was illegal and unconstitutional.
Well, and as your Atlantic colleague and my friend David Frum has pointed out several times, the whole structure of the Constitution is designed to prevent the president from having an independent source of revenue. He has to go to Congress. That's a huge part of the balance of power in our system. If the king in the British system, if the king didn't have to go to Parliament, then he is an autocrat. He's all powerful. So that is a key thing. And Trump keeps trying to end run Congress. And so the tariff scheme is a way for him to have his own private way of raising revenue without going to Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think there's another problem with our constitutional system, which is that, you know, the founders expected every branch to jealously guard its own power. That's true of the executive. It's true of the judiciary. It's not true of Congress itself. You know, Congress has delegated authorities over the years, but, you know, the president says, hey, I'm going to impose these tariffs. I'm going to invade this country. I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. And Congress, you know, because they share the same party as the president, just kind of backs away. And that means that the delicate kind of interlacing of powers and checks and balances just isn't functioning anymore, which is a broader problem.
It sure is. And if we get through this and we get to a point where people are making sane reform proposals, we do have to look at some serious constitutional amendments to right the balance, you know, to make sure, like some people have proposed, for example, that we amend the Constitution to make it clear that not just that the president has a duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, but that his job is to faithfully execute laws passed by Congress. And if you put those words in, it would make the balance a bit clearer, you know, that he is there to execute, not to initiate.
Yeah, yeah. I think also, I mean, this is just goes back to something my dad said, you know, 20 years ago about the importance of character and shame and humility. And all of those things, I think, have just been proven true in that, like, the founders do not expect the president to be a man of unsound character who pursued person, like there is a lot of power that is just inherent in the office, and they always expected that the person who ascended to that role would be able to exercise it judiciously and, you know, for the good of the country. And likewise, they expected that Congress would would have that same sense of wisdom, that same sense of shame and humility. And there's only so much you can write down on a piece of paper if people are not willing to.
Some of it they wrote down on a piece of paper in the Constitution, and it was later repealed. So one thing that they had in mind for the Electoral College was that it would be a layer in between the voters and the president and electing the president, so that the electors would do it. And the electors initially were intended to be, according to the Federalist Papers, people of wisdom, discernment, stature within the community, and not just the rabble, right? And that they would all get together and they would be less likely to be moved by fashion or passion or other sort of transitory emotions as the public can be. But very soon after the Constitution got rolling, that just went by the wayside, and the electors were obliged, first by state law, to vote the way their constituents had voted. So right. The electors became a dead letter. So they tried, but that didn't work out. And there's that one of my favorite quotations from Hamilton, who could be a bit of a snake sometimes, but when Jefferson and Burr in 1800 were locked in a tie vote for president, and it kept going through ballot after ballot in the Congress, which was even then divided on partisan grounds. Mm-hmm. Hamilton, who of course was a big opponent of Jefferson on everything that mattered in terms of not everything that mattered. He was a huge opponent of Jefferson's on philosophy and on what kind of a country we were building. But when it came to Jefferson versus Burr, Hamilton encouraged all of his people in Congress to vote for Jefferson because he said, even though I disagree with him, he's an honorable man and Burr has no principles and mm-hmm. can't have that. And, yeah. You know, and that was the model that we should have stuck with, because character is destiny, as we're learning to our sorrow. All right. So there are other things you mentioned in the piece that I recommend to people. The fact that we're also, in addition to all the things we've already mentioned, under the Trump presidency, we're acting more and more like a third world country. He always thunders that, you know, we shouldn't be a third world country. If we let in immigrants, we'll be a third world country, that sort of thing. No, the way you get to be a third world country is by the rank corruption, is by the sending the message out that the way to get ahead is through political advantage and political connections rather than by, you know, making a better product or being a better competitor, right?
Yeah, that I worry about, the extent to which you know, favoritism within MAGA matters for business. And that's why I think a lot of America's business leaders have justified, it's kind of rational again in the short run to say, okay, if I accommodate this guy, maybe my business doesn't get whacked. That's basically how every country is thinking about Trump, how every university is thinking about Trump, every law firm. Okay, let's just try not to stick our heads too high up and hope it all goes away. And maybe it will. Maybe, you know, Trump is succeeded by a Democrat or a non kind of MAGA Republican. I don't know. But that's a calculation that everyone is making. But I think even still, the fact that the Department of Justice has been reformed in this way just causes people to think that, you know, law is not applied equally. The way that, you know, the president is administering grants to universities and to states and saying, you know, if you're in my camp, you get the rewards. And if you don't, then you're cut out. The way that the president's sons and his firms and, you know, Steve Witkoff's son and their firm, that they're doing rather well and kind of openly, right? They're kind of happily announcing that, oh, we have this defense contract and, oh, we, you know, this rare earth company that we joined the board of now has a Department of Defense, Department of War contract now. Isn't that great? You know, I mean, there's no hiding that. And, you know, my parents are from Pakistan. They're very familiar with that way of thinking, and it's not one that's conducive to economic growth. I mean, Pakistan, just to stick with that, where the army is so enmeshed in every contract, and in having kind of good relations with the army is essential to doing well in business. That is not good for economic growth. Pakistan is now poorer than Bangladesh, poorer than Sri Lanka. It has been left behind compared to the rest of the region. In all sorts of countries where you see this, Egypt, Iran, Turkey, where there is a kind of ruling clique and proximity to it is what determines success in the market. Mm-hmm. All of those places are not places you want to emulate. And obviously America is not there. But the seeds of that mechanism are the same. There's no American exception to this phenomenon. And so the fact that it started and the fact that it's taken some root, you know, is concerning. And I will say, you know, there are other institutions that have been a kind of bulwark to use the name of your publication against this trend, particularly the courts, which I think that you know, on the left, there's been a tendency to say that the courts are all in Trump's pocket. And really, I think that they're the only institution that have effectively constrained Trump from being the worst that he could possibly be on some of these aspects.
Yeah, I do agree with that. There's something to be said for life tenure. All right. Let us now turn to another topic that you've written about. And I think people will be surprised by. So you said that when you were a college student, you were very exercised about campaign finance and about the Citizens United, speaking of the Supreme Court, Citizens United decision, which you regarded as the opening the door to corruption in American politics, to big money. You've changed your mind. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people saw the amounts of money that were being spent on politics and just concluded that really the problem were the donors and the influence that they had over American politics. This was back at the time when the Koch brothers were incredibly kind of prominent, but George Soros was kind of the equivalent on the left. And there was a sense that, okay, if only we could put the genie back in the bottle, if we just didn't have money in politics and it was really, really tightly regulated, you know, legislators would be decent people who could represent their constituents, so they wouldn't have to, you know, bow down to these moneyed interests. And, you know, that was when I started college. Obviously, things have changed. I became a professional journalist and, you know, have been living in this world for a while now. And you know, the Republican Party would be very different if the Koch brothers were still in charge of it, or industrialists, right? I mean, this is, the party's gone in the completely opposite direction of what they expected. So if they had this kind of control over the political system as we imagined, it shouldn't have gone this way. The other thing that changed my mind was that in 2016, you know, the two candidates who benefited the most from small donors were Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, and both did incredibly well. I mean, Bernie Sanders came pretty close to winning the Democratic nomination, much closer than he ought to, right? And so, you know, we're kind of living in a world in which small donors are incredibly important to politics. They fund a huge amount compared to what they did before, and things are not much better, right? There's kind of a valorization of this idea that the common man and their opinion is the thing that really we need to return back to. But I think we're kind of living a bit more in that reality, and I don't see things getting any better. And in fact, what we've seen is that the political parties themselves have become much less important in terms of fundraising. Things have really been turned over, and that's not really made our political system much healthier. So I think that it forced me to question some of my pre-existing political beliefs. And if I could just say one other thing, is that, you know, observing this kind of burgeoning populism, not just here, but everywhere, including a lot of countries in Europe, where money is incredibly tightly regulated. I mean, for them, like $10,000 is a huge amount of money, right? It's the same, right? These anxieties, these kind of discontent with elected officials, all of that is the same, even in countries without stringent campaign finance laws, even those with. So that to me suggests that there's something kind of deeper and more fundamental, and that I think it's still probably good to make people believe that donors are not literally deciding political outcomes. I think that appearance of corruption is a reasonable reason to intervene, but I don't think it's the solution at all.
So you say there are downsides to small donors. So first, let's talk about who the small donors are. Is it every man, or who are they exactly? I mean, how much money are we talking about when we're talking about small donations?
Well, it's kind of a misnomer, because they're multi billions of dollars, and in some cases they're outspending large donors. So in aggregate they amount to a huge amount, but donors are roughly less than $200. Not very much.
Right. But you say they're kind of political hobbyists. They're not actually just ordinary people.
Yeah, they are. They tend to have extreme political beliefs. There's a political science book by Ray LaRaha and Zach Albert that I think is very illuminating. But one thing they do is they look at polls about what do small donors actually believe about the world? How does it differ from hardcore partisans? So basically, they're all hardcore partisans. They're just, you know, people who watch MSNBC all day, Fox News all day, who see, AOC come on and give her $30. Those are the kinds of people who donate small amounts of money. And so the world in which small donors are kind of running the show, which is increasingly where we're headed towards, is not one of like moderate centrists deciding everything, which is, I think, the kind of mental image that people have. It's kind of a distribution of extremes and people on either side donating huge amounts of money. It also, I think, has skewed political incentives in a way that is not necessarily great. So, you know, we did dislike the kind of rubber chicken circuit that politicians would go on, the donor dinners and all that stuff. But what we have now is, if you want small donors, you have to go on MSNBC. You have to say something kind of crazy.
Or online, on Twitter.
You have to say something that gets people to be interested in you. So like your 10-part plan for how to fix Medicaid, that's not what people want. What people want you to say is that, you know, Israel is doing genocide. Or they want you to say whatever the equivalent is on the right. You know, that's how you get people to look at you. That's how you get people to give you money. And that's kind of, it's like the like and subscribe era of politics that I think we've turned into.
And so it rewards fear, anger, rage, all the things that you actually don't want people to, accelerate toward, right?
And to your earlier point about like, why are people so pessimistic? Well, like one thing that's incredibly powerful emotionally is declinism, right?
Yeah.
That's how you get people to, if I run for office and I say, well, actually, you know, American living standards are the highest they've ever been in the world. And isn't that great? No one cares about that. If I tell you, things are terrible because...
Actually, you'll have tomatoes thrown at you if you say things are good.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, 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 exactly, exactly. Oh, I know things could be better, but yeah. But if you instead say, oh, well, the reason that your life is not as good as it could be is because of corporations or because of immigrants, suddenly people are more interested in that.
But people would say, yeah, but the big donors, they also always skewed politicians toward their special interests and their particular needs, and that was corrupting. So that's not good either.
So there's a very interesting political science paper from 2003 called Why Is There So Little Money in Politics? And you heard the title right. But the argument is basically, if it's really the case that giving money to politicians causes a business policy relevant business decision to change, businesses should be giving like 100 times more than they do. This is the argument they make. And it's a very highly cited paper that's out there. So I would say like the political hobbyism is not just a factor among small donors. It's also clearly there are a lot of rich people who are really intensely interested in politics who will give lots of money to it. But I think that a lot of them are motivated by the same kinds of factors that small donors are. Like, I don't think the Koch brothers, I mean, maybe they did it for some corporate tax benefit, but really, I think they were ideologically quite libertarian and they wanted to spend money to encourage America to become that way. And so I think that like the psychology is actually quite similar. I do think that like people's perceptions of you know, politics being corrupting are sufficient reason to try to tamp that down. But I don't think it's really the cause.
So you say that the politician, there's another aspect of this that's worrying for political hygiene. And that is that when the political parties are the big donor, the big distributors of campaign funds, they make decisions, for example, to give to state legislative candidates where they see opportunities. Whereas under the system of just rage bait, you know, whoever gets on TV or online gets the money, you actually can have a misallocation of resources so that, like in that famous case where, I can't remember her name now, Amy McGrath ran against Mitch McConnell. She raised something like $70 million or something. And it was a complete lost cause. And that money could so much better have been deployed in other more winnable races. And this happens again and again when it's based on this model of, you know, rage bait being the way you raise money.
Yeah. I'm actually in Lexington, Kentucky, so I'm Amy McGrath territory right now.
Okay.
By the way, I've
met Amy McGrath. She's great. I like her. I just didn't think she had a shot.
Maybe not 78 million, right?
Yeah.
So you see that misallocation, right? So one of the professors I spoke to, Ray LaRaja, he had this nice turn of phrase, the Darth Vader effect, where because McGrath was running against Mitch McConnell, Democrats hate Mitch McConnell. They will donate kind of huge sums of money to try to see her, to try to see him unseated. And you see that again with Marjorie Taylor Greene's challenger as well, who got, you know, $14 million to lose a House race in rural Georgia by a huge amount of money as well. So you see that going on. There's another problem as well, which is that the parties themselves just become weaker, where you have kind of the small donors who are raising huge sums of money towards politicians who generally are saying that the party establishment is the problem. That's true of AOC. That's true of Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's true of others. So they're kind of funding people, the insurgent candidates who are attacking the party itself. The large donors have their own super PACs and they can distribute money however they want as well. So really, like, the party's ability to coordinate and actually establish messaging, actually make strategic decisions for the party as a whole, is totally eroded by the current campaign finance system that we have.
Will the recent Supreme Court decision help with that?
It should, because
the NRSC.
Because it'll allow parties to raise more money themselves, which will at least ameliorate some of these problems. Because, you know, what we see is that basically there are no limits on how much you can spend on super PACs. The small donors are sufficiently motivated now that they can raise huge sums of money. But the limits that are the most biting are the ones that are on the parties themselves. And that should help. Although, I mean, reading the recent New York Times story on the Democratic Party and their travails, like,
yeah,
there are more issues, right?
Right. But so just to clarify, do the amounts that small donors contribute, do they compare with the amounts that large donors contribute to, not to candidates, but to their super PACs? Are we talking about equivalent amounts of money here?
Yeah. I mean, Elon could, like, you know, part with, you know, 3% of his net worth and maybe exceed it. But I mean, right now, what we're seeing are sums that exceed even that sum of money.
Okay, so what would you do if you were to introduce a campaign finance reform now that would help to strengthen political parties and disempower extremism?
We're not going to go back in time to the Feingold McCain era. So really, the limits that exist on party spending and coordinated spending are probably the ones that you could lift that would actually survive judicial challenge. That's probably the best that I could say right now.
It's funny. We live in an era of absolutely ferocious partisanship and yet very weak parties.
Yes. And one thing that wouldn't fix things would be matching funds for small donors, because that would just, you know, exacerbate their influence. And you know, some people might say it's better small donors than large donors. But if the outcome that we care about is, you know, more rational policymaking that is less emotive and is less kind of rooted in kind of extreme partisanship, that's not the outcome that we would get by matching funds.
Idris Kalun, thanks so much for joining me today.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.